Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. My guest, John Wertheim, has made a career out of looking for a good sports story. But when he thought about the summer of 1984, he found several crammed into one summer. Wertheim's new book is Glory Days, The Summer of 1984, and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever. The book traces the intersection of sports and media at a time when its then-13-year-old author had no problem seeing a rising basketball talent named Michael Jordan around town. Wertheim, the executive editor of Sports Illustrated, is also a correspondent for 60 Minutes and an analyst for the Tennis Channel. John Wertheim, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, and thanks for that intro.
Sure. What got you thinking back on 1984?
I think you read my mind. You said it nicely, which is I thought there were some good stories here. I didn't think that Michael Jordan could sustain a book by himself, sort of compressed into that summer. But I thought that could be an element of a larger story. And I sort of poked around about what else was going on at the time and was astounded by the sort of sheer concentration and density of significant events that summer.
What made that summer different from others? I mean, give us a sense of some of the events we're talking about and some of the personalities.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think, you know, look, every summer there's going to be an NBA champion. Every summer there's going to be a draft, and every four summers there's going to be an Olympics. So I had to make sure this wasn't just, you could have picked any year. Some of this was just happy coincidence, right? So David Stern takes over the NBA and gets really lucky that he gets finally an NBA Finals with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. And then a few days after that, an NBA draft that has Olajuwon, Charles Barkley, Michael Jordan, John Stockton. There was an Olympics that summer. There were a number of events that would loom large. But I kind of realized this was the summer of two things that are not unrelated. One is this was the summer of cable. This was the summer when more and more people started getting these boxes in their homes where they could get more channels than just the three networks. And that brought about a number of changes to sports in particular, but also, you know, to music, to culture, to news. There was CNN, there was Nickelodeon, there was MTV, along with ESPN. This also, for a variety of reasons, some of it probably the Reagan 80s embrace of free market capitalism, some of it technology, some of it media, but this also was the summer when athletes, owners, and figures in sports really started to realize that sports equals business. And we all like sports. They're fun, they're hobbies, they're diversion. They were on after the weather report on the local news, but there's real money to be made here. And whether it's Michael Jordan getting a Nike deal that ends up paying him much more than the rookie contract he would get with the Bulls, or whether it's Peter Ueberroth saying, look, these Olympics are a nice sporty tradition, but there's money to be made here as well. And we shouldn't resist that. We shouldn't hide from that. This was really a summer when sports, capitalism, media technology, and finance collided. And we're still feeling the effects of that today.
Let's get back to that in a second. Before we do, take us back to 13-year-old John Wertheim walking around with a tennis racket in Indiana. What was it like?
I'm in this university town in the Midwest, and Bob Knight is the basketball coach, but he's also the Olympic coach. And he has demanded that all the players who want to be on the team come to him. And it's sort of a sleepy college town in the best of times, all the more so when the students aren't there. And it didn't seem like that big a deal. It was kind of cool. And I've got photographs. It was cool enough so that I took pictures of it that I still have, but it didn't seem mind blowing that you'd go to putt-putt golf and Michael Jordan would be there, and you'd go to the Karate Kid, you'd have to change your seat because Patrick Ewing and Sam Perkins were in the row ahead of you. And I think some of this is a function of where, some of this is just being a 13-year-old and not having much perspective, but I think some of this is a function of where sports were. It didn't seem crazy that I could ride my bike to the gym. There was no lock on the door. There was no security guard. There was no agent. There was no Nike rep. There was no nothing. I could ride my bike to the gym, open the door, and go watch Michael Jordan practicing for the Olympic team. It's endearing. It's nostalgic. But I also think it says something about where sports were then versus now.
The levels of protection around our current NBA stars, you know, between them and kids, but also, you know, sports media, it's really hard to fathom that being the case in this era that you're writing about in 1984.
Yeah, we had the, you know, we have these membranes today. I think that's a really good way to put it. There's sort of these concentric circles, and you didn't have that. Part of it was we didn't think in these terms. Part of it was the athletes, they didn't have the money for a whole PR apparatus. So, you know, there are all sorts of stories like that. I mean, after winning game 7 of the NBA Finals, a game to which he had to fly commercially, you know, traipsing through the airport and going through the metal detector like everyone else, Larry Bird is the NBA MVP. And a few days after that, he's playing in this exhibition game against this Olympic team so they can sort of get some simulated games. You know, LeBron James is not going to finish the NBA season and a few days later play a game for fun in front of, you know, to warm up the next group of college kids. And I think, you know, a lot of this is a function of money, a function of business. Athletes today can afford their own sort of PR apparatus and their own sort of membranes that separate them. They're not, you know, Michael Jordan is not going to the Hertz counter the way he used to. You don't run into athletes flying to games at the airport because they all, you know, even college teams now fly private. So, you know, as sports has gotten bigger and bigger and as money has entered the system, it has had the effect of sort of insulating and creating these barriers between fans and athletes that certainly weren't there in 1984.
You have a job and a career between, you know, SI and the Tennis Channel and 60 Minutes that many kids do dream about. How important was the summer of 1984 to your own evolution as a sports journalist and having that passion for sports?
That's a great question. And I honestly haven't. Yeah, I mean, I think all this sort of, you know, all this was in service of me really taking to sports and not just the games, but sort of understanding sort of the culture and everything that went into it and what athletes do on their downtime. I think also it sort of demystified athletes. And, you know, you're 13 years old and you're watching Michael Jordan by himself in your college town ordering a smoothie or, you know, you see him around and I would always have my tennis rackets and he sort of nicknamed me John McEnroe. And I think looking back, I think it had the effect of sort of demystifying athletes. It sort of took the sheen off their celebrity and you realize they're at some level, you know, they're just like us. They get lonely in the summer when they don't have a lot of people to talk to. They, you know, they make jokes that sometimes hit and sometimes miss. And I think looking back, maybe it had most of all just this impact of kind of demystifying celebrity because, you know, Michael Jordan was certainly not a celebrity when he was hanging around the Bloomington, Indiana putt-putt looking to be someone's fourth because he didn't have anyone to play mini golf with.
Along those lines, a lot of people in and around sports reporting are raising some red flags about lasting impacts of the way sports reporting has been conducted during the pandemic because locker rooms have been off limits and a lot of interviews are, you know, going to Zoom. And there's a worry that access that we've gotten accustomed to is never going to be restored 100%. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this certainly isn't unique to sports media. I mean, I think we're all sort of going to see what things are like when we sort of snap back and what is going to change and what's going to become the new normal. And I think some of this is about COVID accelerating these trends. I think some of this is just about sort of the economics of it all. And it used to be one reason that athletes were accessible. Yes, you had these traditions of media, but also the athletes, the sports, the teams, they needed the publicity. It was sort of this understood bargain that, you know, Michael Jordan needs media to help make him Michael Jordan. And the media is grateful to Michael Jordan because he sells, you know, he boosts ratings and sells copies of Sports Illustrated and Chicago Tribunes. I'm not sure the economics quite play out like that now. You know, at the same time, I think there's a role for media to play. I think fans are interested in stories and interested in stories told objectively. You know, we all love following athletes on their social channels, but I think it does not. I think for a lot of fans, you know, it doesn't quite complete the meal. You're still looking for objective takes and you're looking for questions to go with answers. And I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, some of this is just logistics and how many people can you fit in a locker room, especially when there's a pandemic. But I think also there is a shift in the way athletes and all celebrity sort of deal with media. And I think we're all sort of interested to see how that plays out. And I mean, the good news I would say is people have never cared more about sports. I mean, if people said, I've got no interest in the Phoenix Suns and the Clippers, and I don't really care what happened on the last play of the game, we got real problems. As long as the fans and the customers, the consumers, the viewers, as long as they're this interested, you figure there's always going to be a place to tell the stories of these athletes, even if the typical sort of media access that we're used to and have had for all these decades, if that changes or takes a different form.
As your book focuses on the rise of cable, it also focuses on the survival in the early days of ESPN to become the broadcast, you know, partner and behemoth that it did. As we speak here in 2021, there's, you know, so much fragmentation in how we actually consume the games. Do you think there's, you know, any getting that genie back in the bottle in terms of, you know, kind of a monoculture of sports?
I mean, I think we have it at some level. We have a monoculture of sports. Is we just have it in so many different places where you consume it. So, you know, my son and I both might be interested in how the Philadelphia 76ers didn't fulfill their season, and we can have a conversation about it. We can experience it. We just get it in two different ways. And you know, my Jeff Van Gundy is his phone. I think what's interesting about cable was you had this dual revenue stream, right? Where you had the usual, the 30-second commercials you could sell, you had the advertising revenue, but you also had the subscription revenue. And that came from the sub fees that cable was able to get from every household. I think now we have a double revenue stream that comes from streaming. It's much different, but you have, you know, you have these companies that can make money off of the clicks and the ads. And if you watch something on Amazon Prime, when there's a break in the action, you can go buy a bike. And they also have the value of all the data that they're able to collect. So in a weird way, I mean, I think, you know, just as TV at some level siphoned some of the market off of print, we're seeing that streaming services are siphoning some market from traditional cable. And it's interesting to me that it's still kind of is this dual revenue stream approach. It's no longer subscription and ads, which is what it was for Sports Illustrated, which is what it was for cable. Now the dual revenue stream are sort of the commerce that comes with clicks and the value of data. So it's interesting to me that we have this evolution of sports media, but it's kind of predicated on the same principle.
Along those lines, what do you make of the encroachment of gambling into, you know, sports properties and sports broadcasting?
You know, it's funny how we've evolved. I mean, there was a time not long ago when the NFL would not take a 30-second ad from the Las Vegas, you know, tourist board during the Super Bowl because it didn't want the affiliation. I mean, you had, you know, in the 1960s, you had the reigning NFL MVP and the best defensive player, Paul Hornung and Alex Karras, suspended for a year. You know, it'd be like, you know, Pat Mahomes and J.J. Watt suspended for a year in the prime of their career for gambling on football. We now have obviously sort of, some would say devolved, some would say evolved. We've obviously changed our position on that. I mean, I think that the uncertainty of sports is the great asset. I mean, that's why it's DVR proof. That's why we're all watching the Super Bowl on Sunday and we're not watching it the next day. So the fact that you have this live undetermined event that isn't choreographed, that isn't pre-scripted, that isn't authored, that's sort of the great virtue of sports, and it seems to reason that that would feed into an appetite for gambling. I think it's a big revenue opportunity for all of sports. You can't do this really for other forms of culture, right? You can't really have DraftKings for movies or for TV or for music. I think it's here to stay, and I think that the question now is just, can these sports avoid the obvious corruption that can come with it? I don't think that, you know, I don't think NBA players and their eight-figure median salaries, I don't think are necessarily susceptible to corruption. I think college athletes are, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when we have a scandal and how that plays out. But I also think sort of that you're talking about genies being out of the bottle. I mean, I don't know how these leagues are expected to sort of resist the billions of dollars that are now at play with gambling, because sports kind of lend itself to that. And I think that, you know, in tennis, the sport I cover, this is the second most bet sport in the world after soccer. There are all sorts of matches. There are all sorts of opportunities within matches. I don't know how a sport like tennis is supposed to resist that The question is just making sure the competition stays pure, because the flip side is once the competition goes, once the integrity of the competition is put into doubt, the whole enterprise falls apart. So it's kind of high risk, high reward. But I do think sports gambling is here. It's here to stay. And it's just a question of how it is policed, because I think at this point, it's as much a part of the landscape as, you know, tailgates and cornhole.
We're speaking with John Wertheim. His new book is Glory Days, The Summer of 1984 and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever. People who know the Bruce Springsteen song, of course, know that it's, you know, kind of sarcastic. You take your title from the song Glory Days. And I think there is an undercurrent in this book of you're not necessarily arguing that 1984's changes in sports and media were necessarily all positive. And to that end, part of your book is about the rise of Donald Trump and the way he used sports to kind of further his image. Why did you want to include him in this story?
I think that as much as we talk about him still, and as much as we sort of know the outline of the story, I still am not sure most sports fans realize the extent to which sports really catapulted him into becoming this national figure. I'm not sure also, I mean, it was just remarkable to me how similar the playbook was. I mean, what he did in 1984 with the USFL, he held press conferences at Trump Tower. He bent the truth. It was about media manipulation. There are these articles, again, 1984, that say things like, you know, I'm paraphrasing here by not by much, but they're, you know, he plays fast and loose with the truth, but his magnetism is undeniable. I mean, there were all these sort of cut and paste lines from these articles in the 80s that would apply today. And I don't think, you know, people have seen maybe the 30 for 30 about the USFL, or they may have known he was involved with owning a football team and tried to sue Pete Rozelle. But I don't think they realized how much sports played in sort of the Trump myth-making. And before the USFL, he was just kind of a New York real estate developer. It was really the football team ownership that sort of vaulted him to full bore American celebrity. I mean, I think the other thing, I think the point about Glory Days is interesting, but I would almost, I'd almost push back the other way.
Please.
And say that we all love nostalgia, but when you look back at how, quote, pure, how small sports were in 1984, I think it came at an expense to the athlete. And I think athletes did not have the power. I mean, there was no reason why NBA teams should be flying commercial to game seven. There was no reason why Michael Jordan would be paid nothing to play for the Olympic team, and he had to spend months and months of his summer lonely in this college town. And I think that, yeah, you're right. The same way Glory Days, which came out in the, you know, Glory, Born in the USA came out in the summer of 84, which is why one reason it was a title. I think that's very perceptive that it's not, the song is kind of tongue in cheek, and it's, you know, the older I get, the faster I was. It's sort of this guy, middle-aged guy, looking back and probably inflating his success during his prime years. I think there's some of that here. And I think it's makes for a cute story that a 13-year-old could ride his bike and go watch Michael Jordan play. But I also think I need to think about why that was so. And I'm not sure the conclusions are so great. I mean, I think athletes, it's crazy that Michael Jordan was paid $550,000 by the Chicago Bulls as a rookie contract. And I think that some of the purity of sports that we romanticize and sort of the when it was days and before big money poisoned the system, I think we need to remember that it was often at the athlete's expense that we had this purity. And if this was the summer that athletes realized their power, their value in the market, their platform, the money-making opportunities that they were able to avail themselves to beyond just playing sports, if that's the price of purity, maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Along those lines, you have a chapter about the NCAA and the issue of amateurism, which is still, as we speak, being debated in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you see a breaking point coming on that issue sometime soon?
I mean, I think, you know, Justice Kavanaugh, basically the Supreme Court all but sort of encouraged the plaintiffs to keep pursuing it. And, you know, this was a defeat to the NCAA that we saw at the Supreme Court this week, but a fairly narrow one. I just think the question is going to come down to economics. And if you want to talk about educational benefits and getting players, you know, extra laptops, that's one thing. If we're talking about outright salary, Alabama football makes a lot of money, but most college sports do not. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see whether, you know, once the floodgates come open, this whole issue that we've been sort of theorizing about for decades, do you pay the quarterback the same amount as you pay the center? And do you rely on these boosters to be part of the sort of salary mechanism? I think we've reached a tipping point in a sense, but I also think that just the money's going to run out really fast. And what we're going to realize is that it's a few revenue sports that are propping up the whole enterprise, and that, you know, college golfers ain't getting paid, and life isn't going to be materially different for, you know, 99% of the college athletes. And if these rulings mean that a few star players and a few revenue sports get a salary commensurate with what they bring in, it's probably the just and moral thing to do. But I also think people don't necessarily have a great grasp of finances here, because we're only really talking about a select few athletes in a select few sports that are going to have any leverage.
Just a couple more things for you. I want to pick your brain a little bit on some tennis issues. Two of the sport's biggest stars are skipping Wimbledon to get ready for the Olympics and upcoming tournaments. What did you make of the decision by Naomi Osaka and Rafa Nadal not to play in Wimbledon?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very different sets of circumstances, and it's a blow for Wimbledon. I mean, these are two of probably the five or six biggest players on the planet, and two others, Serena Williams and Roger Federer, are 39 years old. So, it's not great if you're Wimbledon, but I think, you know, the circumstances are very different. I mean, Naomi Osaka's in her, you know, in her early to mid 20s, and she's having, a mental health crisis. She also is under tremendous pressure to play the Olympics as a Japanese athlete. And she is essentially said she's going. So this sort of a mental health break during a difficult time for her. Rafa Nadal is sort of the opposite end. You know, here's a guy who's 35 years old. And I think this is about preserving himself physically. He's already played in multiple Olympics. He's had the experience. He's marched in the opening ceremonies. And, you know, I mean, 35 years old used to mean you were eligible for the senior tour. I mean, it was just a given you were retired, and at age 35, you could start playing sort of legends tennis. He is 35. Novak Djokovic is 34. Roger Federer is about to be 40. And I think one of the costs of having these stars, you know, stick around so long and stick around so long at a high level is that they're not able to play a full schedule. So one of them is an athlete at the tail end of his career, sort of really preserving his body. And the other is a woman, you know, a dozen years younger in the middle of her career, but needing some sort of a mental health month. And you hope they will both be back for the US Open. Again, Naomi Osaka will play the Olympics, but going back to the 1984, this is an offshoot of athletes' empowerment, right? I mean, in another point in time, you'd say, this is crazy. You're a professional athlete, go out there and play. And these are athletes, there's no union in tennis. Everyone's sort of their own contractor. It's not like there's an ownership group or a coach that can bench you. You make your own decisions. And I think, again, this might be an outgrowth of the 1984 style empowerment, where it didn't used to work this way. And now athletes are saying, wait a second, I've got the leverage here. I need to do what's best for me. My priority is me. It's my mental health. It's my physical health. It's not whether Wimbledon has high TV ratings. I'm going to take these tournaments off, and I don't have to consult anyone, and I don't even have to go through the media to announce it. I can put out a social media message. And, maybe this is a stretch and maybe I'm biased, but I would submit you could probably draw a direct line from 1984 to those two decisions that you just referenced.
Last thing, you know, I grew up watching Sampras and Agassi beating each other up, and, you know, maybe Jim Courier would get in there sometimes. And now you've got three kind of late career greats on the men's side who are all right around 20 majors. You know, you've got Federer and Nadal and Novak right behind those two. Where do you think this all ends up? And is the person who finishes with the most championships, the most titles, you know, the consensus number one men's tennis player ever?
Those are great questions. And I was sort of chuckling when you said that. I'm thinking of poor Pete Sampras, who retires 20 years ago. He has 14 majors, most ever. We assume this is one of these, you know, Will Chamberlain's 100-point game. No one's going to top this. And now Pete Sampras is not even 50 years old, and he's a distant fourth on that list. One thing I found is that fans have made their pick, and they love Federer, they love Nadal, they love Djokovic, and nothing can sway them. So, I think numerically, empirically, you make a case that, yeah, whoever wins the most majors that's what you play for. That's the best ever. Djokovic, who I think will probably most likely have the most majors, also has a superior head-to-head against both those two guys. He's had more weeks at number one. I don't think a lot of people are swayed. I think if you like Roger Federer, you're coming up with criteria, right? That he's the most graceful player. He sort of elevated the way tennis is played. He's such a good guy. If you're Nadal, he's won the French Open 13 times, and he had this sort of amazing tenacity. I feel like for most people, they've kind of backed their candidate, and they are not going to be swayed by the equivalent of election results. It kind of makes it fun. I mean, unlike a presidential election, the stakes are fairly low here. I think we talk about the greatest ever, and what is greatest to person A is different to greatest to person B. Personally, I think it's probably hard to overlook someone who has won the most majors and not say they are the greatest. And yet, in women's tennis, Margaret Court has won more majors than anyone, including Serena Williams right now. And if Serena Williams retired tomorrow, in the eyes of a lot of people, Serena Williams is the greatest. So we only need to look to women's tennis for an example of most majors not being the equivalent of greatest ever. It's great fun. I mean, I feel sorry for this next generation. I mean, I could see kids being like, Ian wasn't that good. He didn't even hit double digits. I mean, I think that the benchmark that's been set is preposterous. John McEnroe won 7 majors. Andre Agassi won 8 majors. These are Mount Rushmore figures, and these guys have won more than double that. So it's a crazy time to be a tennis fan. I don't think a lot of fans are necessarily being swayed, but we'll sort of see how this all plays out, and the debates will continue.
We've been speaking with John Wertheim. He's the author of Glory Days, The Summer of 1984, and The 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever. You can also catch him as an analyst on the Tennis Channel and on 60 Minutes. John, thank you so much for taking all this time. Really enjoyed the conversation.
You got it. That was fun. Good questions. I enjoyed that.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.